KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
The new shows that come online are not destined to come to BC, despite the fact that producers, particularly in Los Angeles, really want to come here.
History in the making here on Wall Street. We have the Dow at a record high. All the losses of the financial crisis erased.
I went out, you know, and I never thought that I would be back here. And I am, because of so many of you who are here tonight, because of this academy, because of so many wonderful people who extended themselves to me when they had nothing to benefit from it in Hollywood. You know what I mean? I couldn't get them a job.
That was Argo director Ben Affleck accepting his Oscar a week and a half ago. For that, a news story about the record high closure of the Dow Jones yesterday. And we started that off with Pete Mitchell of Vancouver Film Studios commenting on the dire situation of the film industry in Vancouver. From 94.9 KUOW, I'm Marcy Silman. Steve shares off. U.S. spending cuts affect more than this country. Canada, for example, our major trading partners, a little bit worried about what's going to happen on the border between our two countries. Joining us with this and more stories from Canada, our regular Wednesday guest, Vaughn Palmer, who is in Kamloops, I think. Hi, Vaughn.
Yes, Kamloops, British Columbia, attending a forestry conference. And you're right, Canada isn't just a spectator watching from the sidelines on this battle over the sequester. Canadians very worried that as all those cuts work their way through the U.S. government and its agencies, you're going to have a lot of people who move across the border, not working, and that's going to create big lineups.
Well, I know that the personnel cuts are due to really hit about a month from now, maybe a little bit less. Yeah. So is it going to affect tourism, commerce, all of the above?
Yeah, I think all of the above. The irony here, Marcy, is that Canada and the U.S. have been working to speed the movement of goods across the border and to reduce the lineups around security issues and make things work more smoothly for the automobile industry, which is closely integrated, and other goods, containers. And this is probably going to be a huge setback because trucking companies, the port, the airports are already saying, well, we don't know for sure, but we're kind of worried. And you're right, it kicks in. I think they have to give people a month's notice, so it'll kick in early April.
I know that individual cars can buy a pass that expedites travel. Do truckers have that same ability?
There is some licensing available for truckers, but they are subject to inspection, and if the people that do the inspections, if there's fewer of them, the lineups just get longer. A lot of these relationships are well established, too, and I use the automobile industry as an example because they've had the most experience at this. Car parts will be manufactured in the United States. They'll be moved across the border to an assembly plant in Canada. The finished vehicle will be the partially finished vehicle will be moved back across the border to the United States and finished in an automobile plant in the United States. The industry is so integrated that it just takes for granted the easy movement across the border. Well, if there's problems, that's where that's going to show up. Tourism is the other one. A lot of Canadians go to American airports to fly the destinations because it's so much cheaper. The taxes are much higher on this side of the border, so the airport in Bellingham does very good business out of that sort of thing. So again, you wonder, well, what are those lineups going to be like at the Blaine border crossing in about a month from now?
I'm sure a lot of people are going to be avoiding the discovery because it's on the Sunday evening coming back into the United States, never an easy trip. Yep, very bad already. Well, we'll talk to you in a month and find out what really has happened on a totally different level in just a few weeks. Your premier, Christy Clark, is finding herself perhaps out of a job or at least out of party leadership. What's going on?
So our previous premier, Gordon Campbell, resigned in 2010 because of a series of controversies and a very, very unpopular tax that he brought in, and his political party chose Christy Clark as a replacement. She's got a seat in our legislature, which she won in a by-election, but she's never faced a full-blown election. as premier, and that is written on the calendar for the 14th of May. We have an election every 4 years, and she's facing the music that day. Her government has been looking for recovery in the opinion polls now for 2 years, and it hasn't happened. Their most recent opinion polls put the Clark's party, the Liberal Party, 10 points behind the opposition, in some cases 15 points. You don't win elections with those kind of numbers. There's 10 weeks left, but that's an awful lot of ground to make up. And as a result, increasingly here, the odds favor a change of government and Clark not getting that full term that she wants. She's had some scandals and controversies, too, which have added to it. But, you know, for leaders, when you're down in the polls, nothing goes right, and your own supporters start expressing doubts about you in public as well.
But she's also, as you mentioned, there's some conflict. She's under pressure because of a memo that went out about how to respond to ethnic voters or how to woo them.
Yeah, it was a very cynical, stupid, self-destructive, really, memo that was produced and distributed by her office. And it basically, you know, every political party looks to get the ethnic vote, right? That's natural, especially in a diverse society. You have to reach out to people of different cultures and backgrounds. So that's standard practice. But this memo was so cynical, Marcy, because it talked about how, well, you know, to get these people on our side, we have to look for some quick wins. And one of the quick wins that was suggested was apologizing to Chinese Canadians for a head tax that was collected on Chinese immigrants to BC only 100 years ago. Well, if you're going to apologize for a historic wrong, like the detention of Japanese citizens during the Second World War or some past racial injustice, if you're going to do that, it's got to be sincere. Right? You really are trying to redress a historical wrong. You're not talking about a quick win in the opinion polls with the ethnic community. So there's been a really major backlash from a lot of leaders in British Columbia's multicultural communities who feel insulted, who feel used, and who feel like the apology done that way is insincere. So this has been politically very damaging to Clark, and she's had to apologize for it, but it even took her three or four days to really face up to the apology and make it sincere herself in our legislature. So that's led to the feeling that even there she was playing the political angles.
So that's on top of the fact that the Liberal Party in general is not popular.
Yeah, I mean, you started the year, as I said, 10 to 15 points behind, and they talked about how they had to, you know, build some momentum and close the gap. And the feeling was they might do that. Our elections tend to tighten up, but, you know, voting time comes, some voters tune in and people start paying attention and all that. But the kind of momentum-building thing that usually happens just hasn't happened. And as a result, now when we talk to our leader of the opposition, Adrian Dix, who's the leader of the New Democratic Party, they've been out of power for 12 years, when we ask him what he's going to do, people sort of lean in to hear because the odds, as I say, favor a change of government and a change of government to him becoming premier in May.
Well, we'll be watching for reaction from you and for the response from the voters. Meanwhile, one of the industries in Vancouver that was so red hot sounds like it's dying down a bit, the film industry. What is going on? What's at the root?
Yeah, the glory days are gone. You know, not so long ago, I mean, British Columbia was Hollywood North, was the nickname. Lots of TV series and movies were being made there. We were the, you know,
you were our stand-in. Yes,
Battlestar Galactica, X-Men. We were standing in for all kinds of American communities and cities. I guess what you could say was we're a victim of our own success. We got so good here in British Columbia at attracting movie business and TV business from Hollywood with essentially tax breaks and subsidies that other Canadian provinces got into the act. And they offered the industry a better deal than we were offering. You're now getting, give you an example, the first three X-Men movies were shot partly here or in whole. X-Men 4 and 5 are being shot in the province of Quebec because they're offering very, very good incentives. A lot of our TV business has moved to Toronto because the province of Ontario is offering better incentives. It's a little like what's happening in the United States if you follow the complaints in Hollywood about business going east to Louisiana, going to Georgia and the Carolinas. Same thing's happening here. Other governments are just offering better incentives, more money, and the industry has taken them up on the offer.
Well, in fact, the Washington legislature, not this year, but last session in 2012, extended tax credits that go to feature film production, and in part it was a response to business going north to Vancouver.
Yeah, it's a terrible trap that governments get into, you know, and the industry in British Columbia has put huge pressure on the government to match Ontario's offers. I talked to our finance minister here in British Columbia the other day, Mike DeYoung, about this, and he said, look, we were looking at matching Ontario dollar for dollar, and then we discovered that the province of Ontario had already decided that if we matched them, they would cut again.
Wow, it's like those guys selling used cars.
Very, very well. It's a portable industry. It's a glamour industry, too. Everyone is proud to see, you know, the Vancouver skyline or our scenery up on the screen and all that. But it's a terrible trap that governments get into with this industry because, you know, the next jurisdiction matches you dollar for dollar, and then you got to go lower again. And at some point, somebody's got to sit down and do the analysis of, if you're giving away all this tax money and subsidizing the wage rates, are you getting enough back to justify it? The industry says yes. Our government has said this far and no further, and they are reaping the price in terms of prestige and in terms of loss of business to Eastern Canada.
Interesting. And finally, perhaps the sleeping tiger of stories in our lineup today, U.S. State Department on Friday released its very long-awaited draft supplemental environmental impact statement for the proposed Keystone XL pipeline, and it was inconclusive.
It was inconclusive, although Canada tried to make best of it and said, well, this is encouraging. At least they didn't kill it, and they said they remain neutral on it. I'm not sure we'll ever be able to say finally on this story, Marcy, but the Canadian authorities that want to get this pipeline built to send our oil to the United States remain optimistic, although they're working pretty hard on Plan B up here as well, Marcy, which would see an upgrading of pipelines to Eastern Canada and us feeding our oil to our own refineries in Eastern Canada. So I think there's an awareness here that if this doesn't go ahead south of the border, we may have to move the oil somewhere else, as I said, probably through Eastern Canada.
You know, it's fascinating to me because there's such massive opposition to this down here, and I think there at least is some assumption that if the pipeline to the United States is blocked, that somehow the tar sands will remain oily. I mean, that the industry will stop.
With all due respect to the opponents, and they have done a very good job of raising the issue of climate change to the top of the agenda, with all due respect to them, killing the Keystone Pipeline is not going to shut down the oil sands in Canada. It is not going to end this country's economy's dependence on the sale of fossil fuels around the globe. The oil will find another way to the outlet, I predict, to the world, and production will continue. So about all they will really accomplish, in my view, in practical terms, is to drive up the price of the product, and that in the long run is probably going to help Canada as well. So I mean, yes, the Canadian government would very much like the Keystone Pipeline to go ahead. America's a good customer. It's a good market. But I think that the Canadian government, as I said, is already working on Plan B, which is another way to get the oil into global markets. You won't stop it just by stopping one pipeline.
That's fascinating. Well, Vaughn, I hope your conference in Kamloops is a good one. We'll talk to you soon.
Great. Talk to you again, Marcy.
Bye-bye. Vaughn Palmer is a Vancouver Sun columnist, a regular Wednesday guest on Weekday. He joined us this week from Kamloops, British Columbia. This is Weekday.
The lights are dimmed and the curtains are parting. Quick, find your seat. Our weekly look at the world of film is just a minute away.
Support for KUOW comes from the Columbia City Gallery, a collective of emerging and professional artists, presenting Layers of the Hijab, an exhibit exploring the complexities of East African girls navigating multiple cultures, March 6th through April 21st. More at ColumbiaCityGallery.com.
45 degrees in Seattle with scattered showers. Forecast calls for showers through the afternoon with a high of 48. More showers overnight with a low of 40. And more showers tomorrow with a high of 50. I'm Bernard Ouellette. It's 10:20. What will the sequester budget cuts mean for us here in Washington State? We'll find out in 20 minutes.
Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby to get ourselves a treat.
Delicious things to eat.
The popcorn can't be beat.
The sparkling drinks are just dandy. The chocolate bars are just candy.
That just can mean one thing when we talk about that lobby. It means it's Wednesday, and we welcome back to our studios the one and only Robert Horton live. He writes about film for the Everett Herald, at his site, The Crop Duster, and with us. And I just have to say, when I hear that lobby song, I actually watched the Academy Awards with popcorn in the lobby of the Arc Lodge Cinemas in down in Columbia City.
Yes, how was that? Was that fun?
Well, yes, it was fun watching in that group of people in that place. We can talk about the Academy Awards.
The ceremony itself? Yes, okay.
I just have to ask you a question before we talk about the Academy Awards. And I've never asked you this, but I always wondered, you've probably told Steve why you chose the name The Crop Duster, but I wondered if it was because of the film North by Northwest.
That's it.
Yay!
Yes, yes.
I get the Academy Award.
You do. I have one in my bag right here.
Thank
for you.
Thank you so much. Okay.
That is, if people ask me, as they sometimes do, what my favorite movie is, I say, well, I got like a dozen. But really, North by Northwest, kind of right at the top. I think it just has everything a movie should have, you know. Plus, including my favorite movie actor, Cary Grant. So that's, I thought, I was trying to think of an idea for what to call the website, since everybody needs a website.
Right.
And the Crop Duster has a variety of meanings, I think, including I don't know if I'm driving the Crop Duster or if I'm being chased by the Crop Duster like Cary Grant. And the Crop Duster is just movies and trying to keep up with them and write about them and so on.
So everybody is now picturing the poster from that film as he's running in a suit.
Yes.
A nice gray suit, looking natty in the south of France with a biplane.
Well, he's in the middle of
a field
somewhere, America.
Really, I just think of him as the south of France.
Well, that's the way we think of Cary Grant. No, he's on his way to Rapid City, South Dakota, as he says in that film.
Oh, I think I'm going to have to watch it again. Okay, well, that's always why Robert Horton's website's called The Crop Duster. Thank you for clarifying that. Yeah. All right, back to business. You weren't here last week to debrief live about the Academy Awards, so we're going to do a little, what do they call it, armchair quarterbacking?
I think that's pretty good, yeah.
Post-show. Yep. On your ship, did you get to watch the Academy Awards?
Yes.
Do they have it sort of in the lounge?
There was a little movie theater on the ship. In fact, it was the same room where I was giving my talks. And this was down in the Caribbean, so we were getting a feed from a Puerto Rican station, maybe, as we were cruising along there, and because the commercials were in Spanish, and that was kind of interesting too. But a bunch of people gathered and watched them. Had a nice ice sculpture of an Oscar.
Oh,
which right. don't tell the Academy about that, because that's probably a violation of trademark. So
I
said that.
Learning, and in fact, they weren't even the Academy Awards this year; they were the Oscars.
Oh.
You know, it was an official rebranding this year.
Actually, I did not hear that. Oh, because it's so much shorter and snappier,
and you can tweet it when you're tweeting other things.
It's so now.
Yeah.
To say that instead of Academy Awards, okay.
Okay, so where's whatever we call the ceremony now?
Yeah.
Happening? I mean, is this the program? Well, let's talk about the telecast itself.
I guess it was somebody's idea of bringing the Academy Awards, I'm sorry, the Oscars, into the 21st century or something.
I know, you can beat a horse, but you can't always make it say Oscar.
Yeah, I guess. I thought it was a pretty dismal telecast. I haven't read any of the fallout from it. Since I was kind of in a bubble and away from myself, so I don't know if this is the general consensus, but I'm assuming there must have been some negative fallout about.
There was some negative fallout, but fans of Seth MacFarlane loved him.
Yeah.
And there was actually a lot of kind of pushback to the critics who thought it was dull and awkward and weird.
Yeah.
We did debrief here the Monday after the Oscars with documentary filmmakers Sandy Siafi and David Schmader, who is a playwright and a writer at The Stranger, both of whom had many, many negative comments, and we got slammed by our listeners who thought that we were being overly negative.
Oh.
Some people agreed. Before we talk about Seth MacFarlane, it was odd if we're trying to make it snappy and appealing by choosing Seth MacFarlane, it was odd because there was a big emphasis on musicals and theoretically the illustrious history of the film musical.
Yes. I would say, I mean, even if you think MacFarlane is peachy, it was a weird miscasting of Oscar host. That seemed wrong from the very beginning. But yeah, and particularly it didn't seem to jibe with the general kind of structure of the show, which was very oriented almost toward a Broadway sort of feeling of the emphasis on the musical.
Well, that's because Seth MacFarlane is a great singer.
Song and dance fellow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Among his other things that he does.
Yeah, but then he also made fun of that aspect of the show, which didn't seem quite to jibe either. But yeah, there was a horrifying moment for me when he said something like, and now we'd like to pause and we're going to have a great, you know, production number here, and we're going to pay tribute to the greatest musicals of the last 10 years. And I got, you know, chilled to the bone when I heard the phrase 10 years come out of his mouth, because what are the great musicals of the, Chicago? Yeah.
But I had
and
heard
Les Mis.
Les Mis was nominated, so you knew you were going to hear something Les Mis.
Well, they were all out there, all right.
But I heard that Chicago was, I mean, it did win an Academy Award, but that the producers of this telecast produced Chicago.
Yeah.
And that was why because I hadn't heard the 10-year part before the television program.
I didn't either.
And in fact, there are many great musicals that have come out of Hollywood, I would argue. I like musicals.
Over the last 10 years, though?
No.
Yes, that's the
no.
problem.
No, those were the three musicals.
I love musicals, and I'm big on them. And whoa, you know, if you're giving over all of this time and all of this energy to Les Mis and Chicago, just flat out seem bizarre. I mean, and in some ways, especially to highlight a movie that was actually in contention that year.
Do you think that was unfair?
Seemed to stack the deck a little. Well, and
they've already voted, though.
For that matter, yeah, that's true. But to extend that, didn't they perform exactly two of the best song nominees, and then the others were sort of mentioned as they were reading off the nominations? Like, well,
I think that's right.
Sorry, you guys. I mean, I know you're songwriters and all that, but let's face it, you're not going to win because you're up against Les Mis. I mean, what? and a James Bond theme. So, what chance really do you have?
Well, I'm glad that you mentioned James Bond, because I actually was really disappointed in the 50-year tribute as well.
Yes.
Because, you know, with the exception of this last movie, which had, you know, everybody on the A-list working on it, so it was a little higher caliber than some of them, I'd kind of been hoping that the living Bonds would appear, you know, there, live.
That might have been kind of a nice touch, yes. One can imagine many alternate scenarios to the one they actually did, which was a sort of incoherent montage that, like all montages now, tribute montages, seems to have to go as quickly as possible so that you can't really register what movie might be being shown at any given moment. You're just supposed to have this kind of sensory experience as music plays. It was a total nada kind of thing. It was kind of nice that they then brought out Shirley Bassey to sing Goldfinger. Although also kind of random, as random as Barbra Streisand walking out and singing The Way We Were, even though, of course, it's a tribute to Marvin Hamlisch, wonderful, wonderful Marvin Hamlisch, who I
who wrote music for musicals.
For actual musicals.
Just saying there.
Yeah.
But I guess I'm thinking about, I liked Shirley Bassey. I think that was fine. I was wondering if listeners could tell me if this was a new producer this year of the telecast, or is this... It was.
I think
was.
The two producers were new. Yeah, they were.
So this was the revolutionizing.
Yeah, the Oscars have been trying to find a way to vibe it up a little bit over the last few years, and generally they fail. And a lot of their problem or their thinking is that, well, gee, we keep nominating these, you know, serious movies that nobody goes to see. And
well, they did nominate a comedy, sort of. I mean, Silver Linings Playbook was.
Yeah. Yeah, this has been the complaint over the last few years, and so there's kind of this desperation to try to appeal to the people who went to see the Avengers and the Batman movie, movies that are not, you know, up for Best Picture.
Well, maybe they should nominate them, and that would just solve it.
That would solve it, except those movies aren't better than Lincoln and Lining's Playbook.
I was just going to ask you whether you thought it was time to dump the experiment in nominating, is it 9 or 10 movies for
it's
Best Picture?
10. You could do 10. They did
so it was 9.
To reach a certain threshold.
I couldn't, you know, you have to stop and think about them all.
Yeah, I know.
I mean, that's a lot of movies. Maybe
it is.
Maybe that was a bad experiment.
Yeah, I think it probably was. And it resulted in kind of a chaotic situation this year where you had directors of movies that were going to end up being voted Best Picture, not getting nominated in
five. Oh, are you
five.
Talking about Ben Affleck? And
Ben Affleck, who we all feel so much sympathy for. He got this great sympathy vote. He's handsome and rich and married to Jennifer Garner. He's the poor guy. I mean, he's got so much lined up against him. It's just, of course, your heart goes out to him and you're going to vote him Best Director for Argo.
I just have to say, Jeff confirms the producers of the Oscars were the producers of the film Chicago, hence the Chicago tribute, I guess. Although Catherine Zeta-Jones looked, you know, hot in her little outfit. Maybe that was the reason.
Yeah, well, there's nothing about the execution of it that you can complain. It's just, why was it there, I think, is the question. And there's no, I don't have a good answer for that.
No answers. Robert Horton's here, and we're doing a little bit late look back at the Oscars because Robert was on a cruise ship, so he didn't get to weigh in. Well, let's talk about Argo. Was that the film that should have won?
No.
Are you going to tell me it's a Moore?
I'm going to tell you Amore would have been a better choice than Argo. Yes, a very strong film, but not one that was likely. Although if a foreign film was going to win Best Picture this year, being kind of wide open as it was and spreading all those wins out.
Yes, they were spread out.
Life of Pi and Lincoln and so on. This might have been the year that something like that could have happened. But there was apparently this great groundswell of affection for Argo, a movie that was very, very enjoyable and very well made, very professional, just not a movie that knocks your socks off as the Best Picture, except a lot of people seem to love it. A lot of people seem to feel that way.
Okay, so if you had the envelope and a little eraser, who would you have written in?
Oh, the movies I've written in, I would not have had a chance. Nobody's going to...
Of this list of nine.
Okay.
I'm going to remove a more.
Well, I'll tell you this. I love Silver Linings Playbook. I have to confess.
Me too.
Amore as well, and Lincoln, I think, as well. And Zero Dark Thirty is a film that I think is a great achievement. I'm still kind of going back and forth about it in some ways. But the weird thing to me is that watching it this year, I had that feeling, you know, everybody predicts the Oscars.
Sure.
Film reviewers have done that forever, And often they say things like, and I'm always wrong. I'm really terrible as a predictor and all that. And I have to say, false modesty aside, I always felt like I was pretty good at predicting the Oscars because it's a totally artificial game. It's not what's best. You're trying to anticipate the mindset of the Academy. And I always sort of felt like I had the ability to do that. And this year I have become convinced that I am no longer able to do that because I could not have predicted some of the things. In times past, Lincoln would have been Best Picture. It has Best Picture written all over it. It would have won Best Screenplay for Tony Kushner, did a remarkable screenplay for that film. And it did not win that this year. The guy who adapted Argo won. It's for a kind of a, workmanlike job.
Rick says we should stop complaining. This is what I dislike about living here, the endless complaining that Seattleites do all the time. There's only two of us, so I don't know if you can generalize about the city.
The generalization about Seattle is that we don't complain about anything, I think.
Who is there at KUOW that love the Oscars? Okay. Co-workers, any of you love it? They should be on with you. I loved Django Unchained. It didn't win Best Picture, but you don't hear me complaining. No, we don't, but now we do.
He just complained about us. I don't know. Yeah.
So you've picked up some of that complaining. Django Unchained, when you talk about things being all over the place,
yeah.
That was one.
That's a good example, yeah.
Yeah.
And that also goes back to my new inability to predict the Oscars, which will herefore be true, because I don't understand. I also enjoyed Django Unchained, but I'm not sure why it won Best Screenplay, except that it has a lot of words in it. It's very amusing and very pointed and satirical. But I don't get the logic of why the Academy voted for it over the other ones. And I don't quite see Christoph Waltz winning Best Supporting Actor either over, let's say, Robert De Niro in Silver Linings Playbook. I mean, 10
Two
years
thumbs
ago,
up. I thought he was great.
That would have been an Academy automatic, I think. And I like Christopher Waltz in Django. He's splendid. But all of the cards seem to be aligned for De Niro. He's better than he has been in a while. Seemed more lively. Very, very right on performance. So I'm throwing up my hands now as a predictor of the Oscars. I can no longer get into their minds. And that may be a sign of psychic health for me. Because,
okay.
You know, the farther away you get from the Academy Awards, maybe you're better off.
and with that, Rick, we're just going to take a couple minutes to talk about, we're in the midst of the Seattle Jewish Film Festival. This is kind of a lull in terms of commercial releases, but looking ahead to some things.
Yeah.
But right now, the Jewish Film Festival, which you've missed most
of. I definitely have missed, yeah.
But it's still ongoing, yeah?
It's ongoing, and I always enjoy it. It's always a very well-programmed festival, a mix of fictional films and documentaries and movies that mix it up pretty well, I think, and are sometimes challenging. And I'm going to be clamoring up on stage on Sunday night because I'm doing moderating a Q&A with Michael Benaroya, Seattle native, who is making quickly some waves in Hollywood as a producer of films, picking interesting projects and getting them going and
that's at Centralia College?
No,
that's
here in Seattle, and check your local listings.
Is that of Benaroya Hall?
I don't think it's at Benaroya.
No, Hall, of no. Benaroya Hall.
Yes, this is the family, Benaroya family. It's an interesting thing to make an impression like that so quickly in Hollywood.
We have a totally unrelated to our discussion question, but while you're here, Linda wants to know if you've seen Bless Me Ultima.
Yes, I have.
And what do you think of it?
I enjoyed Bless Me Ultima, a film that is based on a kind of classic novel of Latino writing and a movie told from a child's perspective in post-World War II New Mexico. And I thought the movie, in a way, is a very plain treatment of that, but that seems to be just the right approach in some ways. I enjoyed the film.
So you're now back from your cruise, back at work. What's at the top of your viewing list when it comes to films?
Well, I'm just getting back in the saddle, so I've seen a few things that open this week. Especially foreign films are kind of sneaking in, maybe because, as you say, there's sort of a lull in gigantic blockbusters. I saw a French film called The Monk that's opening, which is based on a gothic novel of the Mary Shelley Frankenstein era.
Wow.
It's kind of a sacrilegious novel.
Wow.
Yes. And a surprisingly straight version of it by a director named Dominic Moll, who made a movie called Lemming a few years ago that was kind of a eerie little number that I had a fondness for. I was a little disappointed in The Monk, maybe because
because you're expecting a lemming.
I was expecting a lemming and you get a monk. But a good performance by Vincent Cassel. Also another kind of World War II themed film called Lore, L-O-R-E, about a German children who are traveling through Germany after the war.
I've seen a trailer for that. Their parents were Nazis.
Yes. And, that's the twist. That's the thing that makes it interesting. Their parents were really enthusiastic Nazis, and these kids are not the usual sort of sympathetic characters.
I'm looking forward to seeing that one, and that might make me old, Rick, but, you know, I embrace it. Robert Horton writes about film for the Everett Herald at his website, The Crop Duster, and you can find him at Seattle's Fry Art Museum every month, where he hosts the Magic Lantern series, and, of course, here every Wednesday.
I'm going to be, the Centralia thing is that I'm going to be at Centralia College this afternoon at 1 o'clock giving a talk on fairy tales and cinema.
So if you're in the South Sound region, head down there.
Get down there.
Thanks. Welcome back.
Thanks, Marcy.
This is Weekday.
Speaking of movies, maybe you've seen Argo, which recently won the Oscar for Best Picture. That was, of course, a dramatized and not entirely historically accurate version of what happened to the six Americans hiding out during the Iran hostage crisis. So if that was fictionalized, what really happened? We'll find out later today when we talk with someone who was there, Mark Lijek, one of the six people rescued by the Argo cover story. Hear the true story that inspired the movie Argo this afternoon at 2:15. In the more immediate future, we'll find out why Seattle's hospital building boom is at an end. That's in Northwest Business News in a minute. KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
It's estimated only 2 in 5 Americans have a will, and less than 5% of all wills contain a charitable provision. Planning your legacy gift to KUOW is easy and can ensure public radio remains available for generations to come. For more information on a planned gift, go to kuow.org/support-future.
It's cloudy in Seattle. We've had scattered showers this morning, and we expect that to continue through the day. We're looking at a high of 48 this afternoon. Expect showers overnight as well, with a low of 40.
Regional coverage of the environment through EarthFix, a Northwest public media partnership, is made possible by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and the Real Networks Foundation.
UNICEF is criticizing Israel's treatment of Palestinian children in custody. The full report in 20 minutes.
From KUOW Seattle, I'm Marcy Silman in for Steve Scher. The federal sequester has taken effect, but observers say it's going to take a little while to assess its impacts. Meanwhile, Wall Street was soaring yesterday. It's up again today. One insider called it the biggest bull market of his career. So what does any of that mean for us here in the Northwest? Joining us today, the managing editor of the Puget Sound Business Journal, Michelle Matassa Flores. Thanks for coming in.
Hi, Marcy. Thanks for having me.
Well, this all-time high yesterday with the Dow, I guess, is great news for companies. Was it good news for Northwest businesses?
Well, businesses here are pretty much tracking the pattern of the Dow, so I guess in a lot of ways you could say it's good news. There's a bit of a cause and effect there, whether it's causing good news for us or reflecting good news that's going on here, you could argue. But yeah, companies around Puget Sound have been showing a lot of strong earnings now for, I don't know, several quarters in a row, just very generally speaking. And that is one big factor they're saying that's causing this bull market.
Any exception to the rule here in the Northwest?
Microsoft is one that is the talk of the town, I guess.
Well, it's a big company.
Yeah, and it's in the news again today.
Yes, it is.
Fined by the EU.
I thought that was settled already. That's in the monopoly case, right?
Right. The antitrust case involving the browser, Internet Explorer, and it's completely, it's either Back to the Future or Groundhog Day. I'm not sure which movie, but this has been going on. You know, it was a big story in the U.S. in the 1990s. I covered that in 1995 or whatever. It just won't go away.
Is this a retroactive fine for them?
Well, yeah, it is, although not
going back
ancient
that far.
History, yeah. It's like 2011 to 12, I think.
Meanwhile, Microsoft's kind of struggling to get all these, well, to get its Windows Phone, all the hardware that it's coming up with. Really, it doesn't have
seemed... It's kind of falling flat.
Yeah.
It's not quite Zune level. That was the big flop.
Well, that's like the Ishtar of the movie.
Right.
We're going to keep those movie analogies going.
That's right. But yeah, they're struggling. There's news today that they're dropping the price of Windows 8. Now,
really,
to try to get sales moving on tablets. You know, that's an operating system that's geared toward tablets and mobile. The stock price isn't going anywhere. People keep questioning whether Ballmer is the right guy to be leading the company. So who knows where that's going to lead.
So this, I mean, a crystal ball, just throw one, pretend you have one. are we going to continue to see optimism on Wall Street and whether it's reflecting what's happening or not?
I would never go there. it's funny, listening to the so-called experts even trying to analyze what's going on in the market right now, they're all over the map. They're reaching for explanations. Nobody quite gets it. And I noticed the first big story yesterday that I saw in the New York Times, it didn't even mention sequestration, which I think might be a factor.
Some people, and I think you might be among them, think that it's just Wall Street's just happy something happened.
Right. You know, they say that uncertainty is the biggest enemy of the mm-hmm. of the stock market. And I guess I would agree with that, having watched it over the years. The fact that they came to no agreement, which launched activity, it's a dog chasing its tail, may have something to do with the market doing well right now. There are some positive kind of street level signs, but they're very tentative in terms of the news on jobs, home prices.
Well, I had heard a preliminary report, actually. Bernard, our announcer, who's just in the other room, said that preliminarily there had been a big addition of jobs to our national economy. That's a good thing. It all is kind of surprising to me because that's before all the people start getting laid off from their public sector jobs, which is one of the things that's going to happen as a result of sequestration.
Right. Layoffs and furloughs. In Washington State, the furloughs are kind of making the headlines. Fort Lewis, McCord,
sure.
I think 11,000 workers there will lose a day a week or something.
So are there any... it sounds like there aren't, but I'm still straining to link what's happening on Wall Street to what's happening in the world of regular people, consumers. Wall Street's up, up, up. So I suppose if we have investments, those are up for the moment. But we're not really seeing an increase, a massive increase in hiring or a massive increase of salaries. So on the consumer level, things are flat, if at best.
Yeah, corporate profits are doing well again. And I guess that is the fundamental thing that investors, you know, you think about investors in the stock market, these aren't little guys, it's huge pension funds and institutional investors. They like that. They, you know, it's a twisted thing, but they like when companies lay people off because that means they'll be more profitable. You and I think both have a hard time linking what's going on Wall Street with what's going on Main Street. The people who live on Main Street don't have a problem with that, I think, because reading the comments on some of the coverage in the last couple of days, they're just vicious and visceral and full of anger about the haves and have-nots and the growing gap.
Well, I've actually read some statistics from various business reporters that imply, if not outright state, that the kinds of profits that we're seeing big corporations, multinationals, or even American corporations take are the biggest since, you know, in 40, 50 years. And whereas wages and salaries are below where they have been, you know, for the last 25 years. So
that's right.
You know, what we're seeing is some people getting really, really rich and everybody else, you know, tightening belts to the point where there's no place to make a hole.
That's right. In fact, there was a, it's kind of hard to explain on the radio, but there was a visual graphic that was made kind of illustrating that trend over time that went viral on YouTube. And it's actually pretty illuminating to watch. They cite some sources, but it's hard to tell exactly where the data came from. But regardless, you know, of the particulars, that the fact is there that the gap has widened and the anger is growing. And, we saw the Occupy movement last year, then it kind of fizzled. I don't know where that will lead or if anything will actually change. But, yeah, the people are angry about the increasing profits, and especially in areas like banking and oil.
with some reason there.
Yeah.
Our guest is Michelle Matassa Flores. She's managing editor of the Puget Sound Business Journal. Well, let's drill down to local now. I could look out my window here in Seattle's University District and see several massive construction projects.
That's right.
It seems like after that couple year lull that at least lenders must be financing development again, or somebody really rich is financing it, because we're seeing a lot of research.
Yes, lenders are getting back in the game, and you could look at that a couple ways. It's obviously good for the economy here, and it reflects good things. I find it a little bit scary because I've been covering this stuff long enough to see a couple cycles where you'd think they learned their lesson about bubbles, and then it turns out they don't. And we've written a little bit. Our reporter Mark Stiles, who covers development, has written a little bit about some fears that we're going to get into a glut situation again, particularly with apartment building.
Well, I once had a developer explain to me that how, I'm not sure if it's the lenders who work this way or whether it's just the industry, that for example, they might focus on hotels for a while and then everything swings to condos. Mm-hmm. And right now it's apartment. It's mm-hmm. sort of mixed use retail apartment, right?
Yes. Yeah, exactly. And, you know, much of that demand is very real and has been for years, driven by things like Amazon drawing people to South Lake Union and all the growth in downtown Bellevue, which is solid, real, and good. But what happens is there's a bit of a mob mentality and among lenders and developers. And when they see an opportunity and dive in, they don't bother looking at everybody else who's jumping in also and what that might create. That's what we saw happen with all the high-rises that went up in downtown Seattle in the 80s, late 80s.
So, you know, on the one hand, it provides jobs for construction workers. That's a good thing. But we may be seeing like all those empty office towers that were downtown. I think occupancy rate is back up.
Yeah. Office rates are doing really well right now. It took a very long time to fill those buildings. And I don't mean to just be like a pessimist. Maybe I'm in a bad mood or something. But I don't mean to be just pessimistic about everything. I don't think this apartment construction boom is anywhere like what the high-rise construction boom was in the 80s. I'm not saying we're headed in that direction. But I do hope that they have their eyes open.
So forgetting bubbles for just a second, mm-hmm. it is, if you look overall, the fact that lenders are willing to open their pocketbooks or whatever it is that mm-hmm. they open, their checkbooks, and finance some of these projects does indicate that we are at some point of economic recovery. People are feeling at least optimistic enough that they want to invest in something.
That's right. The Puget Sound area in particular has done very well. You know, if you get outside of this region, even within this state, there are pockets that are still really hurting. But the economy here is doing pretty well. Lots of tech companies, it's not just Amazon, but a lot of small ones moving in, and branches of Silicon Valley companies moving in here. Those are great, solid fundamental things that will carry on.
And Amazon is still massively growing and developing.
It's just unbelievable.
In South Lake Union, I it's millions of square feet that they're now occupying, if
yeah,
I'm right about
I've
that.
I kind of lost track of the square footage.
Well, once it gets over a million.
It's in the billions of dollars. And
well, that has to be good for the local economy.
Absolutely. You know, you go to a restaurant in that area on any weeknight, forget weekends, and it's so crowded. Every time I go out to eat in this town, I ask myself, what recession, whatever happened? It's jam-packed.
So that's South Lake Union, where a lot of that development's taking place. Right now, the city of Seattle and a lot of controversy are focused in south of downtown, in the SoDo or whatever, and I think the Arena District is now the Stadium District.
Mm-hmm.
The Longshore Workers Union, I think is the official name of it now, has just announced it hasn't yet filed, another suit seeking to block construction of an arena. But meanwhile, the city of Seattle is looking at rezoning. And I know that the city has done a bunch of studies for south of downtown. Mm-hmm. Is this something new?
Well, it's not entirely new, but it certainly seems to have new momentum, I think.
Was that sparked by the arena?
I believe it was. There was some studying going on kind of quietly that people didn't even realize was happening. And, you know, developers, Kevin Daniels is this guy who's building a development in the north, what used to be called the north lot of the Kingdome. It's now just north of, I started to say Questfield, who can keep track, CenturyLink. You know, they were proponents of this kind of change for many years. But certainly now, with all of the kind of rallying behind the Sonics possibly returning to Seattle. There seems to be momentum around creating something like an LA Live style entertainment district around the stadiums.
Which is exactly what workers at the Port of Seattle are terrified of.
Yes.
I'm not sure if it would impact business as they know it, because it seems like it would be at another part of the day, but or whether it's a legitimate...
I go back and forth on that. I guess that's what the studies are all about, but I'm skeptical of a lot of those studies, too. I could see it choking traffic or creating problems, and just that kind of culture clash alone is kind of hard to imagine. But it also feels like it has a little bit of inevitability to it. If you look at what's gone on with the spread of downtown heading north, mm-hmm. We're confined geographically. You certainly can't go west into Elliott Bay.
But there are quite a few people that are worried about the blue collar history and industrial areas in the city. And what does that mean in terms of who we are?
Exactly. And we're working on documenting that right now, actually, at the Business Journal. There's a very rich history in that area that not everybody here appreciates, because there's such a transitory population here, a lot of new people. I wonder about that just personally.
Documenting it for a series of articles or?
For a project we've got going on.
I'll look forward to that.
Yes.
I want to jump back to businesses for a second, because Microsoft isn't the only big local company that's having a problem. Boeing right now, the 787 is indefinitely grounded. There doesn't seem to be any light at the end of that tunnel that I know of or that I've heard of.
Well, the Boeing executives would disagree with you. Yeah, that one is a big dark cloud right now, and who knows how long it's going to be hanging out there. And just when things seem to be going so well for Boeing.
Boeing also has a little problem with labor unions right now.
A real sharp turn of events there, because they reached this historic speedy agreement with the machinists last year. Then the engineers kind of went south on them recently, and now there's kind of a split decision within that union.
So SPIA represents both engineers and technical workers.
That's right.
And the engineers agreed they would not authorize a strike. Is that where we stand right now? But the technical workers did not accept a pension change proposal.
Right. The engineers agreed to the new contract, basically, fundamentally what Boeing was proposing, which was to offer new employees a 401k style benefit rather than a traditional pension. Technical workers didn't agree to that. So they're going to vote starting, I think, tomorrow and over the course of a week or so, whether to strike.
Well, they may strike. What is their workload at this point with the 787 grounded?
Well, the engineers have been working around the clock, we're told. The numbers have varied in terms of how many people they're bringing on and to what extent. But it feels pretty much like full throttle trying to find a fix for this battery issue. They've proposed one to the FAA. Boeing, Ray Conner, the head of Boeing Commercial Airlines here in Seattle, just yesterday expressed confidence, quote unquote, was it yesterday or the day before, in that fix and the speed at which it will be approved. The FAA almost simultaneously said, we're taking our sweet time and looking at this. So it's hard to know how long that'll drag out.
Interesting. Michelle Matessa Flores is managing editor at the Puget Sound Business Journal. And you can keep your eye to their website to find out more about that, documenting Seattle's blue-collar roots. I look forward to that. Thanks so much for coming in today.
Thank you. It's
really appreciate it. Our show is produced by Katie Sewell, Jason Pagano, Amina Al-Sadi, and Andy Hurst. Our intern is Danielle Anthony Goodwin. Bernard Ouellette is the man at the helm. Join us tomorrow. We're going to be talking with the city's contracted police monitoring advisor, Connie Rice. She's going to be in the studio. That and more tomorrow on 94.9 KUOW. I'm Marcy Silman.
10:59. Venezuelans are mourning their late president, Hugo Chavez, who died yesterday. That and more of today's news in a minute.
Support for KUOW comes from Soundview School, a North End preschool through 8th grade International Baccalaureate World School focused on integrating arts and academics. Currently accepting applications for the 2013-2014 academic year. More at soundview.org.
Next time on Latino USA, some controversial thoughts about Latinos and gun control.
We've been having gun violence. We have guns in school every day. I mean, Latinos and African Americans have armed guards at their schools every day. And yet, it's not until the NRA proposes having armed guards in every school that this becomes a concern for Congress.
That's next time on Latino USA.
And you can hear that tomorrow night at 10 on KUOW FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services.
Support for KUOW comes from the Seattle Good Business Network, presenting the semi-annual Dine Around Seattle, featuring three-course dinners of appetizer, entree, and dessert at local area restaurants. Sundays through Thursdays, March 3rd through 28th. More details online at dinearoundseattle.org.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.